Everybody. I had a great week. We took a bunch of us, went off to Yosemite, and the guides climbed Half Dome one day, and then they climbed the Yosemite Falls the next day, and I stayed home and studied Nehemiah. And we went through the book of Hebrews, and it was really most refreshing. Really good to have such good quality fellowship. So we are today ready for Nehemiah, the shortest man in the Bible. That's a Stedman joke. I didn't think of that one. It comes from Ray Stedman. Yes, sir. Bill the shoe height. Oh, he's about shorter still. Yeah, Bill. Yeah. Sorry about that. I make terrible mistakes sometimes, and you want to be alert for them. In 1989, Ray Stedman preached through Nehemiah in a series of 12 messages. They're excellent. I'm giving you Ray's messages in your notes, and they're extraordinarily fine. They're just good because Ray gets right to the practical application. James Montgomery Boyce happens to be teaching, speaking by recording since he's gone home to heaven, but on Saturday mornings on KPEX at 1100 a.m. at 10 a.m. in the morning, you can hear, and you can go on the website and get his back messages on Nehemiah. So Nehemiah immediately follows Ezra, and Ezra, as you know, immediately follows 2 Chronicles. We are 142 years now after Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Jerusalem. And we've seen a lot happening, beginning with Zerubbabel and Jeshua coming back to survey the ruins and to set up the altar of sacrifice. And then we had a time lapse, and then we had the second wave of immigrants coming under Ezra and finishing the temple and getting the temple all completed after it had been in limbo for 15 years. And today we'll meet Nehemiah and what's called the third return of the Jews from Babylon to Jerusalem. And this would be in the year 445 B.C. And it would be some 14 years after the events of last week in Ezra. Remember that when Ezra came in from Babylon with a few thousand immigrants excited to be back home in Jerusalem, he was shocked and horrified to find that a good number of the fine Jewish men had married foreign women. And he was outraged and gathered the community together in prayer and went through a very painful process of having all the leaders in all of the tribes and all the families go through family by family and having all of the mixed marriages dissolved, annulled. And that would include even children born in these mixed marriages. Now, a mixed marriage is not marrying somebody of a different branch of the human race. It's a believer marrying a non-believer. In this case, a Jewish believer marrying somebody who's actually devoted to one of the gods of the Canaanites, one of the pagan gods. And as we looked at that, it seemed to be a pretty severe measure that you would go to such drastic kinds of discipline to put the family of God in order, to bring the people of Israel back to being a separated people committed to God, and that it was a matter of concern for the whole community. I think the population by the time this happened had probably grown up to, say, let's say 100,000 heads of families. And the number of families that had to go through this discipline was 113. We have the list of their names. So that's not a large percentage. It's not. But nevertheless, it's considered to be endangering the welfare of the holiness of the whole community. That's really quite an amazing thing. And both in Ezra and Nehemiah, we see this concern for the integrity of the believing community and its freedom from compromise with the pagan world around about them in one way or another. Well, this is something we don't pay a lot of attention to today. The early church did. The early church had very strict membership requirements and probationary periods and in many cases very harsh discipline for failures, which we would consider too harsh, too severe, and lacking in compassion probably. And the Jewish community, from the time of Ezra, the Jewish community has always had strict discipline for infractions against the law of Moses, essentially excluding people who didn't keep the terms of the covenant. Easily becomes legalistic and easily becomes an insistence on external religion instead of matters of the heart and subject to abuse. But nevertheless, that was, I think, pretty one of the startling things we saw in Ezra. We're going to meet more of Ezra. The first seven chapters in Nehemiah are about the man Nehemiah, and here's how we meet him. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah, and we know nothing more about him or his father. It came to pass in the month of Chislev, in the 20th year, that would be November, December of 445, in the 20th year of the reign of Artaxerxes Longimanus I, who had a reign of some 40 years, and he's the guy that gave Ezra permission to come over some 14 years earlier, so he's relatively favorable. This is the man that received the criticism of the Samaritans against what the Jews were doing to Jerusalem, and he put a temporary halt to the work of God in Jerusalem until he examined the records. So he's not 100% on the side of the Jewish people. He reverses himself on this prohibition when he searches the records and found out that Cyrus had authorized the return of the Jews. So we're going to learn a little bit more about this king. And he's a relatively good king, and he's the son of Artaxerxes, son of Xerxes. Okay. All right. The Persian king that headquarters in Babylon, but he often spends time in the cooler summer palace at Susa, which is in the mountains in Iran, Persia. This time he's in Shushan, that's Susa, the citadel. And one of his brothers, one of Nehemiah's blood brothers, his blood brother Hanani, came with men from Judah, came visiting from Jerusalem, 4-month journey, remember, on foot. So Hanani comes home and visits his brother Nehemiah in the palace of the king, and he brings him a report. And Nehemiah says, I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped, that is, escaped the Babylonian captivity, and I asked them about Jerusalem, and they said to me, the survivors who are left from the captivity in that province are there in great distress and reproach. The wall of Jerusalem is also broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. Terrible news to Nehemiah, who had assumed, probably without any other information, that the believers back in Jerusalem were flourishing in every way, and he imagined probably the city was rebuilt to its former splendor, and he gets this report, know that actually the city was still in ruins and had been for 141 years since Nebuchadnezzar burned it all down. That means it was very hard to live there. Not many people lived there, and there was no safety or security from the enemies. And so there's the functioning temple, but all of the Samaritans and the non-Jews living there said, oh, this is a pretty lousy community that claims to be representing God with this broken down city and all this rubble and this crazy little temple in the middle. And the people living there, small in number relatively, are subject to constant criticism and reproach and mockery all day long. When Nehemiah hears this, it was when I heard these words that I sat down and wept and mourned for many days, 4 months. I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Very instructive prayer here. He says, I pray, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments, please let your ear be attentive and your eyes open that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel, your servants. And I confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both my father's house and I have sinned. We have acted very corruptly against you and have not kept the commandments, the statutes, the ordinances, which you commanded your servant Moses. He didn't say, we believers here in Babylon are doing really well, and those guys over in Jerusalem have messed up. You notice he didn't say that. It's this we. And we, as a community, got to where we are because of our disobedience. My disobedience and your disobedience has contributed to the present state of things, so I'm not out of the accountability to God, and nobody else is either. That's just this. We've seen that. We saw that in Daniel. We saw it in Jeremiah. We saw it in Ezra, this we, collective we, taking your place in the believing community and considering that the sins of the people are your sins, or at least in part. You have some role in that. And you notice the basis on which he approaches God as the God of mercy and grace, the God who makes covenants, and the God who keeps promises, and the God who is ready to restore. So he's coming to God on the right basis. Not justifying himself, not justifying anything that's happened to them. In fact, acknowledging that they've gotten this mess by their own repeated sinfulness. Remember, I pray, the word that you commanded your servant Moses. And he goes back to that list of curses and blessings in Deuteronomy, at the end of Deuteronomy, where there's this whole list of strings of things, good things that will happen to you if you obey God, and rather bad things that will happen if you don't. And the Jews have gone down the road of mostly bad things. If you are unfaithful, Moses said, God said to Moses, I will scatter you among the nations. That happened. But if you return to me and keep my commandments and do them, though some of you were cast to the farthest part of the heavens, yet I will gather them from there and bring them to the place which I have chosen as a dwelling for my name. So Nehemiah is hoping that the present obedience of this remnant is going to be enough to get God to allow them to be restored as a nation and as a community. He's hoping that. The remnant can pull things back together and God will honor this side of the promises. These are your servants and your people whom you have redeemed by your great power and your strong hand. It sounds like Moses, you know, when the people disobeyed and built the golden calf and God was going to wipe them out. And Moses says, what will people say if you don't keep your promises, God? Why did you save these people if you intended to let them perish? That is the same kind of a thing. Holding God to his promise to redeem this people in spite of themselves. Well, the right of the Jews to live in the land is conditional upon their obedience to the land. That's the so-called Palestinian covenant right at the end of Deuteronomy. The land belongs to the Jews forever. Their right to live there is conditional on their obedience. The 70 years captivity in Babylon was a chastisement, saying, look, wake up, you guys. You've been disobeying for a long time, so I'm going to temporarily exclude you from the land for 70 years, and now you can come back on the basis of the original conditions. Well, that's exactly, that's a good point, because the Jews are back in Israel now, 6.6 million Jews in Israel, almost all non-believers, almost all very secular or even atheistic. And why are they back? Well, we got that in Ezekiel. Remember towards the end of Ezekiel when we were back 5 years ago, whenever it was we were in Ezekiel together, that God said that he would regather Israel, the way you put a skeleton together and breathe life into it, and that in the final return he would bring them back unconverted and then put them through this time of terrible testing, and then out of which a third of the people would come to the Lord and two-thirds would be cut off. So this final testing in the land is this: are you going to live up to the terms of my covenant or not? Because if you don't, this time you're going to get not thrown out of the land, you get destroyed. So that's the scary thing about being a Jew living in Israel today, is you're living in the land contrary to the contract, the covenant of the land. There are small numbers of Jews living over there who believe in Jesus. Probably 30,000, very small number, hassled and harassed, and the establishment's against them. A lot of them are pretty wonderful Jewish believers. Yeah? From the government standpoint, certainly not from God's standpoint. Yeah, the government won't let a Jewish Christian move in and be considered a legitimate Jew. So the government's moving towards being an anti-Christian false messiah. I have come in my Father's name and you would not receive me. Another will come in his own name, him you will receive. So one of these days Israel is going to get a prime minister who's this bad guy, really bad guy, this man of sin. They're going to get the worst possible leader because of their rejection of the right Messiah. What will that do to Israel and to the world? Well, it'll provoke World War III, won't it? Yeah, coming soon. Okay, it's your local theater. Don't be left behind. Okay, verse 11. O Lord, I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name. Let your servants prosper this day, I pray, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man. For I was the king's cupbearer. Nehemiah is essentially one of the slaves. His grandfather before him had been taken captive into Babylon, and many of them were just treated as ordinary slaves and servants, and some, like Daniel, were in places, high places. Daniel has a very trusted position with King Artaxerxes. He is the wine taster. And it's very often that the kings get assassinated back then out of the blue, and one of the best ways to assassinate a king is to poison his wine. So you always bring the new wine when it comes in from France. You bring it in, and you have the wine taster, the cupbearer, taste the wine first. And if he lives and doesn't die, then that king, the king can drink that bottle of wine. So this is a man, this position. Now, obviously, if you wanted to plot against the king, you'd go to the cupbearer and bribe him to exchange bottles and say, look, we'll spare you. This is the poisoned wine. Give this to the king and taste this other safe bottle here and lie to the king. Well, Nehemiah then has to be a very trustworthy, dependable, responsible, honest, and then we know now that he's God-fearing. And so Artaxerxes trusts this man. He's right up next to the king, but he's a servant and he's expendable. Okay? Now we find in chapter 2. It came to pass in the month of Nisan, that's 4 months later, around Easter time, Passover time, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes. King Artaxerxes, 20 years into his 40-year reign. Wine was before him. So now the king is having wine with his dinner, so the wine taster is right there to tell the king that this wine is safe to drink because he's previously tasted it. I took the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had never been sad in the king's presence before. Therefore the king said to me, why is your face sad, since you're not sick? There's nothing but sorrow of heart. Then I became dreadfully afraid. Why would he become dreadfully afraid? Well, yes, you got to smile in front of these great kings and bow down to them and always be happy and cheerful. And you must never show any sign that you don't just love serving this king, or it's off with your head. Right? That's pretty common with these big, high-powered kings that are so omnipotent, they just lop your head off if you happen to come in and upset the king's good spirits, especially if he's having wine with dinner. However, I think we can read behind the lines here and see that Artaxerxes really likes Nehemiah. They probably are friends. They probably, and we maybe get a clue as to why that might be. So Nehemiah, as the king says, hey, come, talk to me. Why are you down like this? And I see you aren't sick, and I know the wine's good. What's got you down? Because Nehemiah cannot hide the grief he feels for his people. He said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, doesn't name the city by name, the place of my father's tombs, my family history, place I came from, my ancestors came from, it lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. The king said, what do you request? What can I do for you, my loyal servant? Well, interesting. I said to the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in your sight, I ask you to send me to Judah. Doesn't mention Jerusalem again, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it. So the king said to me, the queen also sitting beside him. Now what in the world's that in there for? There's no reason for that queen to be mentioned. Is that his wife? Maybe. If it's not his wife, could it be the queen mother? If it's the queen mother, who could this woman be? Esther. You suppose Esther read Bible stories to her little boy when she's raising Artaxerxes? Oh, I imagine she did. I expect so. We can't be sure. But the Bible doesn't put those things like that in there for no good reason. So we have to assume that this woman has had some kind of very good influence on her son Artaxerxes quietly over the years, so that he's favorably disposed toward the Jews, as he had been to Ezra before him. From history, we don't know a lot about who this guy married or what his life was like. We know that he lived a long and fairly good reign. You can go on the internet and put in Artaxerxes and you get 100 web pages on the man. So, but I wish we knew more from secular history, and we don't know an awful lot, as far as I know. All right, now then, so the king says, well, how long are you going to be gone? And he says, well, I've got a ticket. I got an economy ticket, and I can fly to Boston for the weekend and come back and be back on my job on Monday morning. So all I have to be is gone for the weekend, and I got a good price on the tickets, and I'll pay my own expenses. He's going to be gone 12 years. 12 years, and the king isn't going to have his important wine taster there. That's a pretty big favor to ask of the king. But the king says, well, okay, you can go. How long are you going to be gone? And I suppose they negotiate something that must have been, initial negotiation would have been, say, at least a year, 4 months out, 4 months back, a few months visiting the tombs of your fathers, and, you know, come back in a year, and it gets extended later on. By email, negotiation gets extended, becomes 12 years. When are you coming back? How long will you be back? It pleased the king to send me, and I set a time. So Nehemiah runs out and finds a replacement from a fellow Jew, probably, that will be a good, trustworthy wine taster and cupbearer to the king, because he cares about the king. And so he puts his affairs in order. And furthermore, I said to the king, if it pleases the king, may I have a letter from you to give to your governors in the region beyond the Euphrates, over to the west of the Euphrates, to the governors, so that they'll know that I'm coming with your approval and I haven't just run away. So that they may permit me to pass through until I come to Judah. Well, that's reasonable. And may I also, Your Majesty, have a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, the whole Holy Land and the whole region then being heavily forested, but all the timber resources being belonging to the king of Persia, you have to have permission to go chop down trees. I'm going to need some lumber to restore the gates of the citadel, which pertains to the temple. In other words, I'm going to make sure the governor's house, your governor's house, O king, is in good working order. And I'm going to do some rebuilding, and he doesn't go into a lot of detail, but I'm going to need some building materials. The king granted, and the house, I need a little house for myself. And the king granted them to me according to the good hand of my God upon me. Now, therefore, you see the power of prayer to move the heart of a what amounts to probably a pagan king. He might have been a believer, probably wasn't. But prayer will do that. If God wants something done, he moves the hearts of kings to get it done. And they become his instruments without realizing they're his instruments. I went to the governors in the region beyond the river, and I gave them the king's letters. It doesn't tell us anything about the four-month journey at all. The king had sent captains of the army and horsemen with me. Ezra went without any military escort with $5 million worth of gold and silver, if you remember. In this case, the king says, well, just as you're a really valuable man, so I'm going to send some horsemen from my army to make sure you aren't waylaid along the trail. Pretty nice. That shows, I think, a great deal of personal interest that the king has in his trusted servant Nehemiah. So Nehemiah goes back. He goes back and takes the long journey. It'll be summertime now, a hot summer, like Iraq has hot summers. And he gets to Jerusalem. But when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite official heard of it, they were deeply disturbed that a man had come to seek the well-being of the children of Israel. Isn't that interesting? Who do you suppose Sanballat the Horonite is? Well, he's an enemy of the people of God, and he worships the god Horon, and he's living in the land, so this is a anti-Semite for sure. And Tobiah the Ammonite, he turns out to have a fierce opposition to anything that God wants to do. And who is Ammon? Ammon and Moab, the descendants of the sons of Lot, who were perpetual enemies of the sons of Abraham and Isaac, and perpetual animosity down through the years. And the Ammonites and the Moabites who lived over in Jordan were extremely idolatrous and into child sacrifice and all sorts of nasty things. So anti-Semitism is not something new. Here it is running rampant 2,500 years ago. Interesting. Violent hostility to the work of God. Opposition to the work of God. All they got to get is news that somebody's going to come and be supportive of God's work in that community, and they get outraged. Interesting. Opposition, anytime you want to launch forth and do something in your life, Anytime. Now, Nehemiah is all about rebuilding. We'll get to that in a little bit. The rebuilding of a life that's ruined and broken down. We'll get to that. I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. Ezra came to Jerusalem and he was there 3 days before he did anything. There was that magic 3 days. Death, burial, resurrection, fresh new start. Now, his secret plan. Rather than coming and saying that right out to the leaders in the city or to anybody what he wants to do, he first goes out at nighttime, probably full moon, and he reconnoiters the whole city. Flashlight, high-powered, one of these new orchard supply, 2 million candle power. No, he has to go out by moonlight without any lights. I came to Jerusalem, and I arose in the night, and I took a few trusted men with me, and I told no one what my God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem, nor was there any animal with me except the donkey on which I rode. So he goes out by night on a donkey with a few trusted servants, and he surveys the whole ruined city with nobody knowing what he's doing. And he goes out by night through the valley gate. That's down at the lowest part of the old broken-down wall, down near the pool of Siloam, probably. And he goes to the serpent well, which is probably the pool of Siloam and the little spring that's down there where Hezekiah's tunnel now is. And he goes past the dung gate, that refuse gate is still there today. And he viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and its gates, which were burned by fire. So the wall that had once been around the city had all been broken down and knocked over, and all the wooden gates had been burned. And so there's just rubble and debris everywhere. What a heartbreaking thing to think of this city that had been desolate for 140 years. I went on to the fountain gate and to the king's pool, but there was no room for the animal that was under me to pass. In some places, the rubble so clogged the footpath that you had to get off his donkey and walk over the rubble or go by a different route. That's just, you can imagine the ruin of the city as Nebuchadnezzar had left it. And the city mostly uninhabited for that whole time. I went up in the night by the valley, and I viewed the wall, and I turned back, and I entered by the valley gate and returned again. The officials, both the Persian officials and the Jewish officials, did not know where I had gone or what I had done, and I had not yet told the Jews, the priests, the nobles, and the officials, or the others who did the work. Nehemiah turns out to be a master at leadership. Absolutely wonderful. And this is James Boyce's sermons focus on the leadership abilities of this man Nehemiah and his strategies and his tact and the way he enlists the whole community to get the work done. He's an outsider out from outside of town. So then after his night survey, he calls them together and he says, "You see the distress that we are in." That's a pretty good way to start. He says, he does not say, "I came from Babylon and shame on you guys. This is a mess here. Clean up your act. I'm going to go back and tell the king of Persia that this city's all run down." No, does not involve the king of Persia. It's we. It's our city. It's our people. It's our ruin. It's our fault. See, that's a pretty good way to get people to go up with on your team. You're not the outsider coming in to be critical of the status quo. He isn't. "You know the distress we are in. You see the distress. Jerusalem lies waste and its gates are burned with fire. Come and let us build the wall of Jerusalem so that we may no longer be a reproach. We serve a great and mighty and wonderful God, and our lives need to honor God, and our city should honor him. Jerusalem is the city of a great king, and it once was beautiful. Let's get it back again to the beauty it had before and to make it the safe, secure place for God's people." I told them of the hand of my God, which had been good upon me, and also of the king's words that he had spoken to me. So he says, you know, actually the king of Persia is quite favorably disposed to you people, and he let me take time off from my work, and he sent his troops with me to make sure I got here, and I'm coming with the king's blessing. And so you guys should know that the current king of Persia is very favorable to the Jews, and it's in his own self-interest to have you guys prosper. It means more taxes and more revenue and more safety. So the king is not any longer impeding anything that needs to be done here in Jerusalem. "Let us rise and build," and they set their hands to do this good work. So they all say, yes, we'll do it. They're going to build 1, 2, 3 miles of wall, maybe much as 3 miles, maybe probably about 2 miles of wall, with a very relatively small number of people all working together and everybody taking a part in it. You know, if they had had a committee meeting and pointed 3 men in the community to say, you guys go build the wall and hire some contractors, you know what a mess it would have been, never would have got done. And people, when you don't participate in a project, you don't have much personal interest in it. So we're going to get everybody, mom, dad, and the kids are going to do this together. It's going to be our city, our work, and we're each going to be, have a little part of the wall that we said, we built this. Well, that's kind of neat, isn't it? That's a good approach. When Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite and now another bad guy, Geshem the Arab, Palestinian terrorist, and Geshem the Arab, militant Islamic Arabist here. So Tobiah and Horonite are consolidating their forces to oppose the Jews. Sounds like today. We're going to drive these Jews out of here. They laughed at us to scorn and they despised us and they said, what is this thing that you were doing? Are you going to rebel against the king? Because they remember earlier that the king had put a hold on the building program, and little do they know that right there in his briefcase, Nehemiah has an authorization from the king, but Nehemiah doesn't pull out that letter from his briefcase. He goes to a higher authority, and he says, the God of heaven himself will prosper us. Therefore, we, his servants, will arise and build, but you have no heritage or right or memorial in Jerusalem. Aha! This land doesn't belong to you, never did. You guys are not here by any legal basis. You don't have any right to the land. It was given to Abraham. It's ours. And our God is with us. Get lost, you guys. This kind of power of intimidation when you're in a weak and defeated position can be very, very effective and very much a source of discouragement. It's what stopped the building of the temple before. Remember when they started building the temple? Eliashib, the high priest, rose up with his brothers, the priests, and they built the sheep gate. They consecrated and hung its doors. They built it as far as the Tower of the Hundred, and they consecrated it then as far as the Tower of Hananeel. That's up in the northwest. Yeah, there's a map in your notes. Say, that's up in the northeast corner, and the sheep gate is the place where sheep are ordinarily sold. It's where the sacrifices for the temple are brought in. Why would the priests take responsibility for that gate? Well, that's what their daily work is all about, is getting the sacrifices into the temple and dealing with that. And it's right in their district. Mark? The world deflation. That's right. And we need to look at, we need, when we're all done with this, we've got to go look at the personal application to our lives that Ray is so good at illustrating. And your notes, you must read through all of your notes, which are 3 sermons by Ray, all there. And that's all on the final exam. And Ray will be waiting to meet some of you that he hasn't met. And he's going to say, did you read my sermons on Nehemiah? What did you think of them? And you'll say, who is Nehemiah? Was that one of those books back in the clean pages of the Bible? And you'll say, well, gee, I didn't know it was in the Bible at all. No, you won't say that. You'll say, yes, we read your notes on Nehemiah. Okay. So now there's logic to which group of people build which section of the wall, repair it. And the Levites are very logically involved in getting the sheep gate running up on the north end. The sheep gate is there today, or the modern version of the sheep gate is St. Stephen's Gate. It's to this very day, when sheep are brought into Jerusalem for sale, they're brought right outside that very same gate to this day. So you can go into Jerusalem, into the Temple Mount, into the Old City, through the equivalent of the sheep gate. They build it off in the direction towards the, along what's now the Damascus Road, off towards the west, as far as a tower that once was there, the Tower of Hananeel. Next to him was Eliashib, and the men of Jericho built. So the men of Jericho lived down at the bottom in the Dead Sea Valley, which is 22 miles down the hill, straight downhill from Jerusalem, 2,200 feet above sea level, and Jericho minus, 1,200 feet. They got to come up that long road and bring their tents and RVs and camp and work on the wall. So they work on the wall that's right near the Jericho Road. Logical? They don't live there in Jerusalem, but they're going to come and build part of the wall. And the sons of Hasanah built the fish gate. They laid its beams and hung its doors with its bolts and bars. Now, the fish gate is up on the north wall where the present-day Damascus gate is, approximately. And why would you suppose it would be called the fish gate? That's where the fish market comes, and that would be, if you took the road right out the Damascus gate and went up to Galilee, you could go up and bring fresh fish into the city, or you could go over to the Mediterranean, and so the fish markets were likely there. And it might be the Hasanah was a merchant who ran fish market restaurants or whatever. We don't know. Next to him, Meremoth, the son of Urijah, the son of Koz, made repairs. And next to them, Meshullam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshabeel, made repairs. And next to them, Zadok, the son of Baana, made repairs. So that tribes, the various tribes and families of Israel, are also all joining in and saying, we will take this section of the wall and it will be our responsibility, so we'll build here. Right? Side by side. And then it's pretty neat to have your name on this list, because this is a kind of an eternal list of reward for people that joined in the building of this wall. It's still very important historically. And Zadok. Next to them, the Tekoites made repairs, but their nobles did not put their shoulders to the work of the Lord. Amos, the prophet, was from Tekoa. Tekoa's out in the wilderness of Judea, about 12 miles from Jerusalem. And so the Tekoites have to come into town. The leaders sort of poo-pooed the building project, but the men of Tekoa came in and worked and did their section of the wall. And then a little later, we're going to find that they came back the second time, did another section of the wall, and ignored their lazy leaders back home in town. Tekoa exists as a little village today. You can go visit it if you want to. I remember Doug Goins and I took a bunch of college students over there 1989, and we had an appointment to have lunch with a Messianic Jew in Tekoa. And our Arab driver said, oh, that's too dangerous to go out to Tekoa. But we went anyway, and then we got our connections lost, and this nice man wasn't home that day. So we had to drive all the way back with the driver trembling for fear of the Palestinians coming out and getting us. But then this nice man came to visit me last year, so at my home, and full of rabbinical insights. He's a Jewish Christian, anyway. Tekoa. I like Tekoa. Moreover, Jehoiada, the son of Paseah, and Meshullam, the son of Besodeah, repaired the old gate. They laid its beams and hung its doors with its bolts and bars. In a minute, we could go back through this list of, I think, 9 gates, and we can see what they symbolize. Next to them, Melatiah the Gibeonite and Jadon the Merianithite and the men of Gibeon and Mizpah repaired the residence of the governor of the region beyond the river. The governor in office by the power of the king is the administrator over Israel. Israel is not an independent nation. It's a vassal state under King Artaxerxes. And so this is not an independent nation. There's a governor there representing the king of Persia, so they thoughtfully put the governor's house in good order. That's a good way to get the governor to be nice to you, and quite appropriate. Yes, Sanballat, that's something I mentioned. Sanballat represents those Samaritans up north, that mixed breed of people that with whom there's such on-term hostility with the Jews down to this day, just about, till Jesus met the woman at the well in Samaria and led her to him, know himself, and most of the people in her town. So next to him, verse 8, Uzziel, the son of Harahiah, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs. Now this guy's wealthy, and he's a merchant, and he's probably doesn't need any income, and nobody's getting paid for this work anyway, but he stops what he's doing and he gets his family and goes to work on a chunk of the wall. Next to him was Hananiah, one of the perfumers, made repairs, and they fortified Jerusalem. So you're going to get that some of the very leading citizens and some of the wealthy merchants and the new to all pitch in and do their part. Rich or poor, everybody joins in. Next to them, Raphaiah, the son of Hur, leader of half of the district of Jerusalem, made repairs. Now, there are people living in Jerusalem, and it'll be relatively easy for them to work on the wall because they can go home at night. Next to him, Jedidiah, the son of Harumaph, made repairs in front of his house. In front of his house. Now that's going to be attractive, isn't it? Because you get to build a wall that protects your house from the outside world. You can make it pretty. You can have flowers growing on it. You can paint it whatever you want, and now you'll be sure that your neighborhood is safe. That's kind of a good strategy that Nehemiah has had. And you live right there, so you can go home for lunch. And once the wall is done, you guys can sleep peacefully because you know that your part of the wall is built right. Pretty good, isn't it? Now, Kijah, the son of Haram, and Hashub, the son of Pathmoab, repaired another section as well as the Tower of the Ovens. And next to him was Shalom, the son of Halahesh, leader of half the district of Jerusalem. He and his daughters made repair. Okay, ladies, you are not excluded. You can learn how to mix mortar and haul rocks and run wheelbarrows and lay stones and hammer and paint and saw. Okay? Women's lib is fully running here. Daughters, this is a part of your perpetual, your permanent reward. It's that you built this section of the walls of Jerusalem. Pretty awesome. I think that's great. Family, this is a family thing. Hanun and the inhabitants of Zenoa repaired the valley gate, and they built it and hung its doors with its bolts and bars and repaired 1,000 cubits of the wall as far as the dung gate. 1,000 cubits is 1,800 feet. That's a lot of wall. When Ray Sedmund and I were in Jerusalem, I forget what year, 83 or 84, we ran onto one of the Jerusalem archaeologists that I know over there, and he took us and showed us a chunk of Nehemiah's wall that they'd excavated. There it is. Big, great, thick wall. It's not a little teeny wall like you have in your garden. Big, thick wall.
A boulder plan.
Very good. That's just kind of, Ray was all corny like us. This is crazy sense of humor also. Okay. Shalom, the son of Kol Hoza, that's verse 15, leader of the district of Mizpah, repaired the fountain gate. He built it, covered it, hung its doors with bolts and bars, and repaired the wall of the pool of Siloam by the king's garden, as far as the stairs that go down from the city of David. Again, you can look at your map in the book, and you can see what we think Nehemiah's walls were like compared to the present walls of the old city. What we think. Now, nobody hardly knows, because we've only found a couple of little chunks of Nehemiah's wall. And there were a lot of other walls. Jerusalem's been destroyed 23 times, I think, in its history, and rebuilt a lot of times. When possible, the gates built along the would be the natural barriers. But the trouble with the north invasions come always from the north. The north is relatively unpredicted. The slope of Jerusalem goes steeply down to the Kidron Valley and the Valley of Hinnom, and so there's some places where you're simply just going to have to build a high wall right out in the middle of a valley because the terrain. Now, you can, I'm sure if you go look on the internet and you look at it, you get aerial photos or pictures of Jerusalem, you can see the topography of the land and see the lay of this wall. Now, the Dung Gate and the Valley Gate are down low, quite a few hundred feet below the north. But the invasions came from the north because the armies could swoop right in from the north. Now, let's see where we were. 16. After him, Nehemiah, the son of Azbuk, that's different Nehemiah, leader of half the district of Beth-Zur, made repairs as far as the place in front of the tombs of David, that's down at the southern end, to the man-made pool of Siloam probably, and as far as the house of the mighty, that would be king's palace or king's governor's palace. After him, the Levites, under Rehum, the son of Bani, made repairs, and Hashabiah, leader of half the district of Keilah, made repairs for his district. People from various parts of the town had a vested interest in the wall that was in their part of town. After him, their brothers under Babai, the son of Hanadad, leader of the other half of the district of Keilah, made repairs. Next to him, Ezer, the son of Jeshua, the son of Mizpah, repaired another section in front of the ascent of the armory of the buttress, defense, fortification, army. After him, Baruch, the son of Zabai, diligently repaired the other section from the buttress to the door of the house of Eliashib, the high priest, so going around the whole city. After him, Meremoth, son of Urijah, son of Koz, repaired another section from the door of the house of Eliashib to the end of the house of Eliashib, and the priests, the men of the plain, made repairs, so that all classes in the society joined in. And Benjamin and Hashab made repairs opposite their house, right in front of their house. After them, Azariah, the son of Masiah, the son of Ananiah, made repairs, and Benui, the son of Henadad, repaired another section from the house of Azariah, and Palal and Uzai made repairs opposite the buttress and on the tower that projects from the king's upper house by the court of the prison. Very specific details. After him, Padiah and Nethinim, who dwell in Ophel, made repairs as far as the place in front of the water gate. And the Tekoites came in. Now, here's the people from Tekoa come in and build another section, help out beyond what was expected of them. And then beyond the horse gate, the priests made repairs. And Zadok made repairs in front of his house. And then came Shemaiah, who became the keeper of the east gate, made repairs. And then another Hananiah and Hanan repaired another section. And Meshullah, son of Berechiah, in front of their houses, their part of town. And Melchijah, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs. And between the upper room and the corner, as far as the sheep gate, the goldsmiths and merchants made repairs. How long do you suppose it took to do this whole project? 52 days. Do you suppose it went smoothly? No. Next week we'll find out how unsmoothly it went, because the enemy now is going to come in full force. Now, nine gates. I would like to have a quiz here and have you tell me the symbolic meaning of these gates. Now, think about the temple in Jerusalem as being the picture of the human spirit. This is the place where your spirit meets God's spirit. This is the central heart of your life. You are the temple of God, and your spirit and God's spirit meet at the place of worship in the temple of your heart. Right? And that's the sanctuary. That's the Holy of Holies, and God, the Holy Spirit, has come to live with your spirit, and he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit together with him. So we have the temple running, and when a life is restored, worship is restored first. Worship, thanksgiving, praise, and intimate relationship with Jesus. We saw that in the rebuilding of the temple. Now, why do you need walls around Jerusalem? What do you need in your life to protect you from the flesh, the world, and the devil, besides the worshiping spirit? Do you need to guard what comes into your life and what goes out of your life? Do you need defenses from the world in which we live? Yes. Do you need boundaries? Do you need safety and security? Okay, then you need walls in your life. Walls of separation, but with gates in the walls. Now, tell me what these walls are for. The sheep gate. We already talked about the sheep gate. Is there a sheep gate in your life, and what does that suggest to you? Jesus is our shepherd. That's good. And the sheep that are coming into the temple are coming to the sacrifice, so the sheep gate is a reminder of the cross. And following. Okay, good. All right. The valley gate. Valley gate, down at the bottom of the valley. Valley. What does the valley gate remind you of? Of your position in life and your place in the world. Lowliness, humility, going back and getting at the end of the line, and being willing to be obscure, and the path of lowliness and humility. Valley gate. Does that make sense? Fish gate. We talked about the merchants bringing fish in there, but what else about fish gate? Come and I will make you fishers of men. That's the evangelistic function of our lives, where Jesus teaches us how to fish and how to bring people to himself. So that's a vital part of our Christian lives, is the fish gate. Old gate. This is where the present Jaffa gate is. It's be off on the west side of the city. What's the old gate there for? What does that remind you of? Truth never changes? The old truth is still the only truth, that if something is once truth, it's always truth. The truth doesn't change. So you always can go back to the anchor of the authority of the Word and the authority of God, and that's never going to change. how we apply it does change, but we always got to go back to those anchors. Okay? And the old gate is going to go back and stop and think about the men and women that have gone before you and the tradition and the heritage we have and how we got where we are today and God's faithfulness. Isn't that one of the most helpful things about your Christian life when you're discouraged is to look back and see how God has met you time and time and time again? Isn't that always good to go do that? Especially if you're discouraged? Yes. Now we come to the dung gate. Self-evident. That's how you get the garbage out. Do you need to get any garbage out of your life ever? Probably not this group, but I know friends who do have to go empty the trash from time to time. This would be confession of sin. This would be cleaning all the clutter out of your lives and tidying up things so that your house becomes a house where God can be at home. Fountain gate or water gate? Holy Spirit, the Holy... He who believes in me out of his innermost being will flow rivers of living water. Plus, another function of the water gate, the washing and cleansing of the Word, the daily cleansing, the foot washing, the washing from the defilements of the world. Water gate? East gate. Yes, sir. It's right. Very good. Yes, that's right. It was one of the gates that didn't need to be repaired. I think it's the gate. East Gate. It's now the Golden Gate. Golden Gate was built by Saladin, I think, by the Turkish invaders after their crusades about, 1100 A.D.? And it has the two parts. It's closed. It's a closed gate because they don't want the Messiah coming in there. But they, in the Muslim tradition, the Golden Gate has a gate of repentance and a gate of mercy. And you go in through the gate of repentance and come out through the gate of mercy is the idea, but they block the gate so you can't go in and out. The Golden Gate, now what's the East Gate, what does that stand for? The sunrise is in the direction of the sunrise, and the East Gate is where the Messiah comes from. Remember when the Shekinah left the temple back in Ezekiel, way back then, when the Shekinah got up from the Holy of Holies and left Jerusalem, and Ezekiel saw it in a vision, and the Shekinah glory of God and the chariot throne of God went up to the east wall and then took off for Babylon. And where is Jesus coming? When Jesus returns, where is he coming to? The Mount of Olives, right on the east of Jerusalem. And the east gate is the place of the triumphal entry. And the east gate is when Jesus entered Jerusalem on Palm Sunday. East gate, Messiah, hope, fits. Muster gate, also called the inspection gate. Muster gate, inspection, accountability, self-examination, transparency, openness, re-examine. You have to re-examine your life every once in a while, see how you're doing, make course corrections. I certainly do. Muster gate, that's good. Come and let's gather together and give account of ourselves. And the horse gate. What horse gate? Warfare, spiritual warfare. Yeah, we're in a battle zone, and we got to mount up with God on the horses and go out to battle. Isn't that obvious, unavoidable, the symbolism here that I'm sure Nehemiah had no idea what this symbolism would be last all the way down to our time. There it is. So this is our lives being rebuilt. And Ray's message notes on this are very, very helpful to help us see the damage and the hurt and the ruin in our lives from sin that may have lasted for years and how God goes through restoring and rebuilding the walls and rebuilding the Jerusalem of our hearts and putting the temple in good working order. And this is also not a story of one individual. It's a community corporate thing. It's the health of the whole body, the whole community. We're all in this together. That's one of the great things about this book, Nehemiah. Now, yes, ma'am. Thirty-five times. That's great. Thank you very much. 35 times the word repair is used. It's kind of nice to know that God is always ready to repair and restore and heal and rebuild and put in order that which has been ruined. Yes. Oh, yeah. If one group of people here didn't build their part of the wall, and as we'll see next week when the enemy attacks and tries to stop this, the threat of the enemy is to the whole building project, and every part of the wall is important to the integrity of the whole wall. Now, that's New Testament Christianity, too, because the integrity of the church depends on the vitality of every member. Mark? Yeah. And in Ezra and Nehemiah, every time there is a milestone, such as the completing of the altar or the temple or the finishing of the walls, there is spontaneous rejoicing and worship. It isn't forced or contrived. It's something that you simply cannot contain yourself with the joy that God brings. Well, that's genuine Christian life overflows automatically, and you don't have to fake it. And that's in this book. Well, we'll pick up four chapters next week if we can, and be ready for the battle. Now, if you're taking this seriously, you can expect some spiritual warfare and resistance from the Horonites and the Samaritans and the Arabs and the flesh and the world and the devil. So hang in there. Yes?
I would like to commend you on your willingness to pronounce every one of the names.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your tutoring in this matter. And how about if you pray for us?
Reflecting on what that means in our own lives, Lord. Bless the rest of the morning.